This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room. It's you, it's me. It's a big issue, top experts, and 28 minutes. Let's go. And this week, the great social care crisis. Will the latest government proposals fix it? Cast your minds back through the long eons of time to last month, when the government finally announced major changes to the funding of social care in all parts of the UK. In England, a new cap of £86,000 was announced, above which people would not be expected to contribute to the cost of their own care. And new money for social care, paid for by an increase in national insurance, was promised, but not for a few years. As ever, it takes a bit of time to analyse what this all means. So a few weeks on, what can we now say about the future of social care? Step inside the briefing room and we'll find out. Let's start by reminding ourselves what exactly the government is now proposing. Joining me in the briefing room is Alison Holt, the BBC's social affairs editor. Alison Holt, what are the main facets of the new social care policy that the government announced?
Well, the headline to it is its cap on care costs. Now, this is an £86,000 limit to the amount of money that any one person is meant to pay towards their care during their lifetime. And this is to answer a really age-old problem, which is that there are some people who end up paying thousands and thousands of pounds towards their care because they might arrive at old age or disability thinking that they'll get support from the NHS, but the sort of personal care at the heart of what care homes and home care staff do is not covered by the NHS. So that £86,000 cap is the headline to the changes. And they are also going to increase the amount of money that people are allowed to keep before they get help. So at the moment, if you have savings of more than £23,250, savings or assets, then you will pay for all your social care. The government is introducing a tapered system which says if you have between £20,000 and £100,000 in savings and assets, then you will get some help towards that care. Below £20,000, your care will be paid for. Above £100,000, you have to pay for it yourself.
What are the objectives of these changes?
The objectives are simply to try and end a fundamental unfairness in the system, or what's perceived to be an unfairness in the system, and one that has been complained about for a long time. And that is, you know, is it fair for someone, for instance, who has dementia to get no help with their social care, compared with someone who has a more medically recognised illness, such as cancer or something that the NHS treats. So it's trying to deal with that unfairness. There's a second element as well, and that still revolves around the money. The care system is in crisis at this moment in time. And we have care providers, we have councils, and the knock-on effect on hospitals. They're all saying, we're going to struggle to get through this winter. We're short of staff. We can't provide the level of support to meet the demand that is out there. And £5.4 million has been allocated to England over the next 3 years to try to deal with the cap coming in and the changes to the system. There's a huge amount of scepticism about whether that can really achieve that, whether there is enough to achieve that. There is a concern that it's been used as a fix to deal with the politics, but not necessarily the reality of the difficulties people are facing.
How many people do we know are going to benefit from this?
We've yet to find out exactly how many people will benefit because there are lots of caveats to the way in which this system is going to work. For instance, with the care cap, only your care costs will count towards it. So, for instance, if you're living in a care home and you are charged £1,000 a week for that care, not all of that will be covered by the cap. Only the element of it which it is decided is the care cost. Now, that could be set at £500 a week, or it could be lower than that. And that's going to decide how many people or how quickly people reach that £86,000 cap. Because some people have the cost of their care running into hundreds of thousands of pounds. That is generally funded by the selling of their home. Now, it's interesting in the document that the government has published, it is backing away from saying no one will have to sell their home to fund their care. What they are saying is that you can defer payment. There's a almost like a loan system that allows you to borrow the money until after your death when your home is sold. But they're backing away from that promise of no one will have to sell their home because with the sort of sums of money we are talking about, very few people have that in savings or ready cash. Therefore, the main asset that people have is their home. And the likelihood is that even at an £86,000 cap, there will be a lot of people who have to or decide to sell their home. The key difference with a cap, even when it's set at that level, is it gives you some certainty about the amount of money that you are going to have to pay towards your care, should you end up in the unfortunate situation of needing that sort of support.
Now, how does the social care policy compare between England, these plans are for England, and the other nations of the United Kingdom?
In the last two decades, the care systems in the devolved nations have become increasingly different. The biggest difference is Scotland, where about 20 years ago, they introduced an element of personal care. So if you're in Scotland, you get your personal care paid for. That is a contribution of around just under £200 a week to support someone, for instance, if they're in a care home, they get support if they're at home. There's more support for people who need care at home in Wales and in Northern Ireland. So the least generous system at the moment is the system in England.
Alison Holt. So that's the latest on what's on the table. Now let's look at the need that it's supposed to meet. What's the position with social care right now? Peter Beresford is visiting professor at the School of Health Sciences at the University of East Anglia and co-chair of the disabled people's organisation Shaping Our Lives. Peter Beresford, these latest proposals affect adult social care. Now, when we say the words adult social care, what are we talking about?
I think the evidence shows that most people just don't know until they need it. But what it's meant to mean is that if we need some sort of personal or social support, perhaps because we're older, we're disabled, we have a learning difficulty, we have a physical or sensory impairment, something like that, then we can turn to public services to get that support. That's the plan.
So essentially, the idea that it just really refers to people with dementia, which is what a lot of people believe, is completely wrong.
Well, that's troubling, really, isn't it? Because the reality is that about half of the people who might come under the auspices of social care are older people. The rest are people of either of working age or indeed children.
As things stand today, what do we know about the demand or need for that support?
So in one sense, we do have some understanding. We know, for example, from what Age UK tells us in relation to older people that there are well over a million older people who are not receiving support from the social care system who could benefit from it. But we don't really have anything like the knowledge that we do in relation to the National Health Service and health issues in social care about what unmet need there is. Social care works on an entirely different set of principles to the National Health Service. It works on you qualifying in terms of what's identified as you having the need for support and what's identified as you being means tested, whether you need to pay for that support. Now, the problem is the bottom line is what rules here. So if a local authority doesn't have enough money, whatever description's given to those needs, you will not qualify because as it is now, they are ultimately responsible for not overspending. And I know that the trend over the years that I've been doing research has been to fewer disabled people receiving less support. And it's created what everybody calls, including governments, a long-term crisis of social care.
So we have a long-term crisis of social care whose dimensions we don't even know.
That's the interesting thing, because we're guessing, you know, we're fishing in the dark. I do know that when a group of us carried out a large-scale national project looking at social care and how it could be got better, that we found there were two major problems which all our efforts to improve locally couldn't combat. One was the money problem, and second was the culture problem. The kind of culture that predominates in social care is not the kind of well-being culture that we've increasingly been advised to pursue within healthcare.
Now, such survey work as has been done, or such evidence as we do have, does it suggest need differs across the UK?
The problem that people encounter in the existing social care system is that if you move, then you may be adjudged differently to where you were, and you may not receive the support you did receive where you were. I would suspect there are two issues at work here. One, that needs will vary, just as we know that healthcare needs vary according to geography, but also the capacity and the ability of different local authorities to respond to those needs also varies.
How good is the data on need, and could we, should we improve it? Is it practical to improve it, or do we just have to live with the fact that data in this area is not as good as we would like?
Organisations like Skills for Care have been collecting data on the workforce, for example, for quite a long time, doing it well. We've just had the latest report, which shows a continuing crisis for the workforce with new problems. In fact, there is a way we can sort this out much better, because I don't think our data is adequate. The general issues we do know. We do know that need can only be expected to rise as people get older and more of us happily survive, but we need some support. But one of the things that doesn't happen in social care, probably because of the worry about what you might find, is we do not collect systematically unmet need. Now, I mentioned before Age UK establishing in older people unmet need. We know from what we hear from other disabled people that there are many unmet needs amongst working age disabled people, because people are getting less and fewer people are getting support from the government service. What we need to start doing in a systematic way is to record unmet need, and so that over time we can begin to know how to budget, how to record those needs and respond to them better.
I want to understand something, because it strikes me from everything that you and other people have said that this is an area of competing responsibilities, which can also mean an area where people want to pass the responsibility on to other people. So we currently have, don't we, as responsibility to provide social care, central government, local government, private companies, and indeed families.
Yes, and it's a system that has been in operation really for quite a long time now. Various efforts have been made in the past to get something together to analyse and improve them. The most recent until the present reform suggestions was the Dilnot inquiry. I'm not sure if the problem here is of competing responsibilities and of the failure of any one of those participants to take on the responsibility they've got. I just wonder if the system is just not a workable one. But it's also actually accompanied by an incredibly sophisticated and complex financial model. And that's made it so that we often have failures of care providers. And also it's very difficult to decipher where responsibility actually lies. And we know that the consequence of this insecurity is that some older people are left without support and emergency arrangements have to be made, which can be very difficult and painful and damaging.
Peter Beresford. Now let's bring together the government's latest proposals with the state of social care today and also do a bit of crystal ball gazing. I'm joined in the briefing room by Sally Warren, the Director of Policy at the King's Fund, who's also worked in local and central government, and by Jill Manthorpe, Professor of Social Work at King's College London. Sally Warren, to what extent, in your view, does the latest government plan fix social care?
The Prime Minister's plan announced last month makes a start at fixing some of the problems in social care, but doesn't go anywhere near fixing social care and getting the job done. What the Prime Minister announced was how to better share the cost of social care between the individual and the state. And that is one long-held problem in social care. But there's also a whole set of other issues around our workforce in social care, which is low-paid and not recognised and rewarded well, high levels of unmet need, providers who find it really hard to be able to stay in the market and deliver good quality care. And really, the Prime Minister and the government's announcement has made no real significant policy announcements on any of those areas. So it's a start to one of the really important questions, but by no means a job done.
In broad terms, Jill Manfort, do you agree with that?
Yes, indeed, David. This was a very easy step to take because it was ready baked, as we might say, from 2014. It's going to take 2 years to come into place, however, so people who might think that it was going to affect them really need to be thinking about what their situation will be in 2 years' time rather than start today's calculations.
Now, will people, because this has always been the big thing that people, press and others, have concentrated on, will people no longer have to do things like sell their homes or their parents' homes to fund social care? Jill?
Well, what we're talking about is about a capital asset, which for the British public is enormously emotional. And I think one of the things we would say positively about this is that it is addressing a very deep-held public concern by those individuals that have this capital, this asset, own their own house or expecting to inherit it. But of course, what we have to realise is that a lot of people don't own their own houses or have any expectations of a high-value house. And so it's a little bit more complicated than just that straight issue about people won't have to sell their house. They'll probably still have to realise the value of it in some way and in some form.
Sally, one of the things that was quite widely said after the announcement was made was that it was unfair because this just meant that rich people would benefit from these changes. Is that the way to think about it?
No, I don't think it is. And I think there's two different ways to think about this. So one is a really important part of what was announced is it wasn't just a cap cost model of £86,000. It was also a change to the means test. So at the moment, you have to spend all of your money down to £14,250 before you get care for free. But that's going to rise to £20,000. And that's the first time that's risen at all for more than a decade. So actually the means test has changed to mean that people of lower and more moderate wealth will get more help from the state. And that's really important. But I think the other thing just to remember is the cap is about people who are unlucky enough to most likely in later life need an awful lot of social care. So they're not benefiting because they're wealthy from the cap. They're benefiting because they have been unlucky enough to have very high care needs. And the core principle about the cap cost model was about trying to address that unfairness that you can't insure yourself against that very, very low likelihood but high cost of needing a lot of social care. So who benefits here is all of us because we've got the peace of mind that we won't have to face those catastrophic costs by ourselves.
When should we expect the promised new money to actually get to social care?
So we don't really know yet. So the government's announcement was a new health and care levy would raise around £10 billion over the next 3 years for health and social care in England. But the vast majority of that money is going to go to the NHS in the first few years to support recovery from the long waiting lists, etc. So we've been told just over £5 billion will go to social care for the next 3 years in England. But we haven't been told kind of which year we'll start to see the money. So obviously there's quite a concern that we might not see that money until 2023 or 2024, when actually there are some immediate needs now to support the workforce, to support people needing social care and to support providers.
Jill, when will we see things altering?
Well, there's going to be various decisions made about the financing of social care. And of course, a lot of people finance it themselves, so their money keeps maintaining the system. In respect of local authority responsibilities, we'll see a lot of changes happening in the next 2 years as all the calculations are made and the preparations are made for helping people in terms of advising them about what their situation will be. So for local authorities, there's going to be a need to hire new staff, particularly those with administrative skills and financial skills, but also advisory skills so that they can help talk people through this really emotional, distressing time of their lives when they're realising that perhaps social care, that they're going to have to rely on it so heavily.
Now, of course, there's, as ever, a complexity in this, which is the cap
as I gather, will apply to England, but the extra money applies across the United Kingdom. So I imagine different arrangements will be coming in Scotland and Wales, Jill.
Indeed, and let's not forget Northern Ireland in this equation as well. We've had a natural experiment taking place in Scotland for some years now in respect of personal care being free. But I think one of the key things we've learned from that is to be very careful about what is defined as personal care. And while social care covers a whole range of things in respect of people's well-being, their activities, sometimes where they're living, the personal care bit is a little bit more restrictive. So I hope that people will focus on that and not think immediately that all care will be free. Otherwise, they're going to have very dashed expectations of the new move.
To what extent, Sally Warren, do you think that what has been offered so far will alter the problem of the staffing crisis in social care?
I think the proposals around the workforce in social care are completely inadequate in the face of the scale of the crisis we have. So if we think about the social care workforce, earlier this week, Skills for Care, a leading body that understands our social care workforce, published new statistics. It said there are 100,000 vacancies in the social care sector. There's around 400,000 roles that turn over every year. So there's a huge amount of vacancies that mean it can be really hard to meet people's needs. And what we got from the government was £500 million over 3 years, but with no detail about, you know, how that money might be shared out amongst the 3 years. Some broad commitments to supporting the workforce, for example, through extra training places or through workforce wellbeing initiatives, but nothing about pay. And this is a sector where the pay is at or at some points below the minimum wage. Care workers are now getting paid less than people in retail, less than cleaners. And that means that people will be leaving the sector because this is hard work in the social care sector to go and work in other sectors where they can get paid more. So pay is going to be a critical thing about attracting talent and keeping that talent in the workforce. And talent is absolutely what we need. Social care is a hugely challenging role, hugely important, and can be transformative to people's lives. So we really need people with the right values working in the sector.
And how much of this is also about people coming from abroad, specifically from the EU, which they can't do now? How much of a gap does that leave?
So that does leave a significant gap for the social care workforce. It's particularly noticeable in London and the South East, where a higher proportion of the workforce has been from migration. But right across the piece, what it means is that because social care isn't on the shortage occupational list for migration, that a key source of labour, which has been a factor for the last decade, is no longer available. That means you need to rely on people in England to want to work in the social care sector. That's where you need to be thinking about pay, about conditions, about how you can support people to see that this is a good role where you can make a real difference.
Jill, as we've mentioned, local authorities play a huge role here in a way that they don't in the National Health Service. And you painted a picture where they will go away with their calculators and so on over the next 2 years trying to work out what they're going to do. Do you think, from what you can see, that they are going to be able to manage what the government and the public is now expecting of them?
One thing I think we've learned about local authorities is their capacity to manage has been almost infinite. They've coped with incredible cuts over the last decade. They've coped with taking on responsibilities under the label of social care that previously were very much the work of the NHS. But of course, it is incredibly strapped. There are population changes which are providing great pressure. And of course, that's really welcome if you're living much longer. And also local authorities themselves haven't got the staff and the resources to manage this massive change programme. They're going to have to really build that up in the next couple of years. Going back to what Sally said, however, what I think we also must think of are people who work as managers and administrators within the social care sector. We tend to think of people on the front line quite rightly, but everybody needs a manager, a supervisor, a team leader to help people at work. And that is an area where social care really needs to think of career structures as well as just the front line. You need to be able to think of progression, develop skills, and see social care as a rewarding career rather than just a temporary job.
Sally Warren, let's now talk about the private providers. There was a wholesale move over to private provision of social care. What do the changes, do you think, mean for the business model of private providers?
The social care sector is a very large and diverse one. It is mainly provided by the private sector, but with some charitable organisations as well. I think it's important to recognise that when we talk about private providers here, the typical social care provider is a small business employing no more than 50 people. So I think at times people can think this is all about big corporates, but actually this is very, very small local businesses. In terms of how the announcements will impact on them, really, it's not beginning to tackle the big problems for social care providers. So for the last decade, social care providers have not been being paid enough to mean that they can meet the costs of care and deliver good quality care. So really, what providers need to see is greater certainty of the funding that's going to go into the social care system and a guarantee that they will get paid a fair rate for care. And I think this is absolutely critical for providers, because if that fair rate of care isn't at the right level, that could be really destabilising for providers, because they are required by law to deliver safe care that's regulated by an independent provider. They need to make sure they can meet the needs of the people who they are supporting. So it's absolutely critical that they have certainty that they can be paid enough to be able to meet those obligations.
Now, we've heard that a lot of the details that we need to properly understand any new system are yet to appear in a white paper whose date is not yet clear. So I'm going to ask you both this. It's a difficult question. How optimistic are both of you that the requirements for good social care that you have been talking about will actually be met by the government's forthcoming plans? Jill first.
Well, I am an optimistic person, David, so probably you must take that as read. I think that there has been a great deal of pressure from people representing families, representing older people, representing people of working age who are disabled, to tell the government that really social care needs to be up the political agenda. And I think that makes us think that a white paper will have to respond to those. So we hope that that pressure will continue. However, many MPs don't get many letters about social care, and perhaps that advocacy needs to be a little bit more amplified nowadays.
Sally, that's a kind of advocacy position almost. So my question to you is, OK, that might be what one hopes for. Is it what one expects?
So unfortunately, I'm in the pessimistic camp at the moment. And that's because there's a lot in the government's announcement that I think are the right principles. So the cap cost model, I absolutely agree, is the right way to share the cost between the individual and the state. It's already been legislated through for the Care Act 2014, and implementation was thought about at that time. So we've got a bit of a head start to make that happen. But for me, the fundamental issue is that we've got to wait for that reform. And in the meantime, there's no real commitment to investment to sustain the current social care system, support providers and the workforce. So my real worry is that the spending review, which will happen in just a couple of weeks when the Chancellor stands up and gives the settlement for local government, my worry is that that just won't be adequate. And that will mean local authorities from next April will really, really struggle to be able to meet the needs of their local populations. That means providers will struggle to be able to increase pay to support their staff over the next few years. So my worry is about how well the social care system can continue for the next couple of years before reform starts to happen from 2023 onwards. So a bit more pessimistic from me.
Sally Warren there with Jill Manthorpe. My thanks to them and to Alison Holt and Peter Beresford. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirsty Knight and Soila Aparicio. The sound engineer was Graham Puddifoot and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've explored the state of British rivers, not good, the UK's energy crisis, what happens when universal credit uplift is stopped, and the threat to peace in Taiwan.
This is Add to Playlist, a new podcast from BBC Radio 4 with me, Keris Matthews.
And me, Jeffrey Boachie.
Ditch the streaming algorithm as we take you on a musical journey of discovery.
In each show, we'll create a playlist of 5 tracks chosen by Keris and myself. And with the help of a different studio guest each week, we'll explore the rich and unexpected web of connections between the music you love, hate, and haven't even heard of.
That's a promise. We'll go under the bonnet of our compositions and look closer at the nuts and bolts to reveal what's behind our favourite tunes.
Just search for Add to Playlist on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.